It's channel one over. Channel one over. I'm setting it up for Leslie. It's channel one over. Channel one over. And I'm setting it up for Leslie. I was pooped out sometime. Tape Mr. Tuck Mack for 2.5 hours. And all morning I worked on the tape we made with him last night. So we went out to let the cows, bring the cows out of the rye and do a thing or two. In the dark, it's a dark night, Leslie put on my old boots over his shoes, a pair of my old boots, full buckle boots. And then he and Faye went in the parlor in the front room, talking away in there. And I just been washing dishes and putting on breakfast one thing or another and trying to clear my head. This is channel one over. Channel one over. And I'm setting it up for Leslie Street.
I'm very disappointed. to his credit is, of course, that, you know, I could do whatever I wanted. I wasn't forced like somebody in a TV program to go into something when I didn't want to. I don't remember.
You never had any temptation to go into...
Oh, I wanted to be a doctor for a long time when I was a boy. It was always the thing, I mean, once I passed the engineer on the train stage, you know, and that sort of thing, the truck driver stage, and had some clear ideas about what I wanted to be, it was always that I wanted to be a doctor. And there was no change for years. It was just a standard part of me as a boy until about 2-3 years after I studied piano. I'm sure I told you this story about when Linton Herbert and I were talking about what we were going to be in the Boy Scouts, and I was about in eighth grade by this time, and I had begun to have some doubts about becoming a doctor, and was beginning to. It was getting from black to gray. I was thinking in terms of becoming a psychiatrist or a psychologist and teaching in a college or something like that. And we were talking about careers, and Linton said that such and such a career would be a great career, and that's what he was going to do. It wasn't a doctor, I'm sure. And I said, well, you know, Linton, a good career would be, if you had money and time, and it wasn't so much a matter of earning a living, a good career to go into would be music, don't you think? And Linton said, oh, no, that would be a terrible career. Why would you ever want to go into that and spend the rest of your life playing the piano and all that drudgery? And to him, it was just the most horrible career. So that's the first time I ever remember thinking about music, and then it was sometime later after I went to Tallahassee and studied with Mr. Kalenyi. I guess that sort of enabled me to make the decision to go into music. And that,
well, that
was not questioned for several years, you see.
That sort of eased you out of medicine.
Right. Well, I'd already begun thinking, you know, in terms of, well, I was going to get an MD, and then I was going to get a PhD, and I was going to be like Justin Harlow's father and teach psychology in a university, you see. I had something to compare with. I could use him as an example.
You talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know the speed of it. You know, everything on the television has such a slow pace. They can't speak Shakespeare anymore. They can't go ahead with the lines.
Really?
Yes.
Is that? They teach them to speak a certain speed.
They don't,
I guess,
teach them that way. That's just the way they do it, and that's what it's conditioned to. You see, if they talk fast on television, they run you crazy.
It runs me crazy anyway, but if they were to speed it up, I guess it really would.
Well, I know that your mother and father were a little surprised at the music angle, but they never did.
No, I was. The feeling was always. I know that my father didn't want me to go into it, and he would say, "Now, why do you want to do this? You should not do this for A, B, C." I mean, he gave reasons, you know, all many of which were quite valid, that the monetary side is bad for a man to go into it. And he said, you know, there'd be someone on TV, and he'd say, why do you want to go into music? Look at that child of 10 or something who can play circles around you. And that even today, don't you find that somewhat disconcerting when you see one of these little brats that gets up there and plays Liszt note perfectly, and sometimes rather musically too? I mean, this just, I'm still, I guess I have too much vanity, but I still can't quite
look
come
what
through
it,
those sessions.
Look what it would do to your performers around your local performers. and you don't know Miss Lois Dixon down at McIntosh. You see, that really puts her out of the running when the children do that. Because she doesn't keep up with call.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so, it's just like painful.
Yes. Well, it's but, I mean, I don't know whether you knew him or not, but the year before me in Gainesville High School, there was a very fine violinist. Charles Coe was his name. He was one of Mrs. Reeves' proteges, and he played the Mendelssohn, and he played very well, and he had a great gift for music.
He's still a little bit fine.
And he was literally forced into something else by his father. I mean, they wouldn't pay for the boy.
They wouldn't put up with it.
They wouldn't pay for it, for him to go to school and study music. And I never had that. I mean, my parents made terrible sacrifices so that I could go to this place where I could study music and do something academic as well, which we all felt was the thing to do. And I think that you and Mrs. Town were very wise to urge me to do that. Because I think you saw that, you know, my interest in this line were just as great as they were in music, and I wouldn't be happy in a purely musical environment or career. It's too bad in a way that Linton didn't have sort of the same possibility, you know, so that he could keep both going and still come out with 2 degrees or something, but, you know, in medicine you can't in the same way.
Leslie was saying that the family profession for years, generations back, had been MDs, and that his sister, his only sister, is going into medicine.
She hopes,
she
of
hopes.
Course. may not get into medical school anywhere, but she's applying to, well, $52 worth on her examination application. It's $2 for each one, I think, beyond a certain number. So she's applying to a lot of places, including Florida and other medical schools. But I think my father perhaps didn't go into medicine himself, both because of the Depression and because of his... He had a certain, how would you describe it? Wild oats characteristic or something? I mean, he was very solid in some ways, but he didn't... he just couldn't settle down. And I think particularly when he was a young man, this must have been more characteristic of him. He just didn't want to go to school for all those years, I think. And then, what with the Depression, there was no money, and his older brother had done it, but he couldn't, and so he went into pharmacy. But I think it was a certain disappointment to him that he didn't go into medicine. And so I think it was hard on him when his eldest son changed his mind, decided not to do that.
Yeah.
But, and then the next one, too, I mean, Daddy used to talk about how James was going to be a great football player and how he was going to be a doctor, and James fizzled out on both of those, you see. Though before the end, he had some gratification in both of us because he was quite pleased with the veterinary idea. And
certainly he was pleased with you.
Yes, when I decided to go into science. He could understand becoming a college professor. These were contemptible people. They only had one pair of pants and they shone in the back from being worn thin and all that, but this was something he could understand. I mean, he could understand why a person would become a college professor. He never would, but but why anyone would go into music was just, he couldn't really understand that. It was not comprehensible to him. So,
and then when you shifted again,
I guess it really threw him off.
How did you get into that, Leslie?
You mean from music and to the other?
Yeah.
My logic at the time was...
You just got bought.
No, I'll tell you one thing. Leslie went to Oberlin with my saying, you're not going to music unless it's a living fire, and the only thing you can do, you've got to go into it with 2 subjects.
And
Ms. Williamson and I both.
Yes. By the time I finished up, I mean, I was, you know, picked to play at graduation, so, you know, I was one of the 4 or 5 best in the graduating piano class, and we had about 20 majors, of which 10 were really quite good, and I'm quite sure I could have gotten into a good graduate program and gotten a master's and gotten a better fellowship than some of the others did. But on the one hand, I felt I wanted to go on in my academic work, and on the other, I didn't want to do something where it wouldn't be just music. I mean, to me, teaching theory is not music. I don't care how you look at it. I just wouldn't like to do that sort of thing. And I wouldn't like to teach a classroom full of little kids either in class piano. That's what one of my friends was doing the next year, you know, to earn his fellowship money so that he could get his MA in piano. He had to assist in one of these laboratories where he taught 30 little kids.
Scared off.
Not really scared off. It's just that I felt that I wasn't good enough to be a concert pianist, and I didn't think I really wanted that kind of life anyway. If I thought I was good enough, and I was sure that I wasn't, and I was pretty sure that that was the only thing I wanted to do if I wanted to go into music, or else I just wanted to be somebody who stayed home and played all the time, or gave lessons now and then. But I didn't want to be somebody who had to assist with the theory classes and do these other things. And I did feel that if I went into classics, there was no danger of my dropping my music. If I did, I knew I'd feel so guilty that I'd be awfully unhappy most of the day. You know, I knew that I wouldn't give it up, but I also knew that if I went into music, that the other side would necessarily have to be given up, and it would have just been sort of a preparatory phase, which was very good for the homo totus, if you like. I mean, the whole man, you know, many people major in classics at Harvard, and they go into medicine or law or something else, and they never read a word of Greek except when they write a prescription, you know. But it's preparation, the liberal arts education. And I didn't feel that I wanted to just, you know, stop at this point, but that I wanted to go on and do more in classics. And I thought that I could do both, and I see now that you can't really do both as well as I would like. And I'm amazed that some people do. There is one man who teaches classics at Carleton College who really is quite a competent musician. He gives recitals every now and then, and plays difficult modern music and things like that. But when I begin to check into these stories more carefully, and I realize that this is a person who really is not as good as he sounds. In the first place, he never plays anything but modern music, and he doesn't find Beethoven very interesting, and there's something bad wrong with that. It's obvious that he's playing modern music because people, it's like I rewrote that Hindemith piece I was just looking at. Do you remember that night when
I rewrote
that piece because I couldn't remember it due to nerves, I guess.
And Lila, Dad said it was the best thing
on the program. And I rewrote it, I really did. I had hardly any of the notes were right. And so that enters in. And then as far as his classics is concerned, he doesn't ever write anything. Of course, that doesn't mean much if he's making contribution to teaching, but I've had other reports that indicate that he's not too much in that line either. I mean, he's sort of out to pasture in the classics, and giving recitals, playing John Cage and Stockholm.
Now, how'd you get all that scuttlebutt left?
Well, when I heard about him, I naturally I heard this glowing reports from a person who was obviously trying to make me feel bad because I didn't do this sort of thing, so I followed the story up. Turned out he had been at the same place where a friend of mine was, so I asked him and got the whole story. But it is true, the Greeks have some proverb about chasing the rabbits, which I probably told you before, that you can only chase one rabbit at a time. If you see another rabbit, and you go after it, that's the end. And when I went to Germany for the summer, my Greek friend said, well, why are you going to Germany? Why don't you stay here for another 2 months? I'd been there for 2 years, and work on your Greek a little bit more. If you go after this other rabbit, you'll never get anywhere. So she was right in a way. I thought Greek all summer, trying to speak German.
Well, now you have become a reader of epitaphs.
At least I don't take rubbings.
don't take rubbings.
Which is sort of the ultimate.
I miss that.
And what is rubbing? Now you have to tell us.
Oh, it's it's kind of the sort of thing that one might do in England or even around Ithaca, where there's some old tombstones and you go around on a bicycle with pieces of paper and a pencil, and you put your paper down on it and you go like this with your pencil, and that records it for you, you know, just a rubbing. But I can just see an epitaph, and if it doesn't have anything of grammatical interest, I can pass right on without taking a rubbing. So my professor would probably take a rubbing. But what was it that he did? The little temple of victory up on the Acropolis is built right out on a bastion, and it's ever since various earthquakes, it's been structurally unsound where it is. So twice it's had to be, well, when they found it, it was a heap of rubble, and the Greeks put it back together. It's fairly easy to put back together an ancient building in the classical period if you just have the blocks. You can usually fit them right together and get your building. From various cuttings on the rocks, you can tell. And they put it back together, and they have these little glass things between the cracks. And if one of those cracks, then that shows the building has settled enough that it has to be taken apart and put back together again, or something has to be done because it's in danger of collapsing. And of course, if it did collapse, it would be powder, probably, a lot of it, and they don't want that to happen. So this particular building has been taken apart twice and put back together again. And down inside it somewhere, there is an inscription, which only comes to light during times when it's apart. And my professor was down there, and he didn't realize this, and then all of a sudden I showed him the inscription there in the basement, and he was frantic. You know, he had no means, he had no camera with him, this was his last chance, you know, so he did have a piece of paper and a pencil, and so he tried to make a rubbing, but unfortunately he was unsuccessful. He didn't have enough. The inscription was not possible to make a rubbing. The letters weren't deep enough or something. I mean, it was too far apart. It was sad that you'll have to wait till disassembled again to make a rubbing.
Well, now, Leslie, that's, you see, I taunted you then. You gave my shoe. Would you say you're a student of literature?
I think so.
Well, I think I am too, but it's we're in different categories.
You don't read the epitaph.
If you are, I'm not.
No, that's not necessarily true.
No, I'm not talking about epitaphs. I'm talking about what you explained to me. Don't you know when you had Christmas? Don't
we were
you know
talking
you
about
read
Homer.
Some of Homer and all like that.
I'm not sure I remember what particular tack I was taking, but I suppose it was the
you just
scientific
picked out those
one.
Passages to show what Homer was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it for
you? Hector before the wall, and
yes.
There were some scenes from that.
Yeah.
We were talking about whether or not you could just pick it up and read it along,
uh-huh.
as you could. What was it you were reading? The Idylls of the King or something you had?
Yes.
I can't remember what you had.
I've forgotten, too. I've forgotten.
Green Knight, I think
yes,
it was.
You read Sir Gawain.
Yes,
something like
yes,
that. I don't know
right.
just what it was.
Sir Gawain. And I picked out that passage from Gawain, you see, of... at the beginning, at Twelfth Night, or somewhere along there, where
mm-hmm.
the author is the heart of the chivalric tradition.
Yes, yes.
And he can't eat until he tells a knightly story or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a charming thing. And it's English. And it's... see, it's comprehensible.
But Homer?
It's moderately comprehensible. It's translated English, and that is not quite English.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as near English as Tuck-Mack is our place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tuck doesn't, you see, he's he has marvelous pictures in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
But his prose, you see, his direction is never quite strong enough to shape his prose.
Mm-hmm.
Never quite strong enough to shape his prose. So, it's not elevated.
Yeah. Well, it's not literature at all either, is it? It could be made into literature, perhaps, but it isn't just as it is it? Well, I don't know. About your question.
Well, now, let me see. I'll say that again.
What is it that you do, or
yeah.
about Sir Gawain that makes you a student of literature, or what is it about Sir Gawain, per se, that makes you a student of it, that you say that I either don't do with Homer, or can't do with Homer, or it couldn't be done with Homer at all. What is it?
Now, this is Roughing It.
Mm-hmm.
And they're starting out from St. Joe, Missouri on the state school.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on top of it, sitting on mailbags. Another night of alternate tranquility and turmoil. But morning came, by and by. It was another glad awakening to fresh breezes, vast expanses of level greensward, bright sunlight, an impressive solitude, utterly without visible human beings or human habitation, and an atmosphere of such amazing magnifying properties, the trees that seemed close at hand were more than 3 miles away. We resumed undress uniform, climbed the top of the flying coach, dangled our legs over the side, shouted occasionally at our frantic mules, merely to see them lay their ears back and scamper faster. Tied our hats on to keep our hair from blowing away, and leveled an outlook over the worldwide carpet about us for things new and strange to gaze at. Even at this day, it thrills. It thrills me through and through to think of the life and the gladness, the wild sense of freedom that used to make the blood dance in my veins on those fine Oakland mornings. Now you see, that has, that's not eloquence or anything like that, but that has a feeling for prose, you see, that Mac, the tough Mac,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's a little afraid of that.
Mm-hmm.
But now you see, you're close to that. And I see there's no art in this.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, the art may not be apparent, but surely it must be art to arrange all of the things in the manner that he has. I mean, isn't there a selection process? And I mean,
yeah.
This is where his genius is, isn't it?
Yeah, he has a great gift, you know.
To describe
yeah.
this in such, you know, perfect terms.
But now, you see, I can't pick up your material.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, what I would do is say, you see, there's nothing in Hector that would give you that same. And you see my terminology. We haven't worked out.
No.
that,
nothing in the Iliad, let us say, that's quite like this. Well, of course, part of that's due to the fact that this is a completely different type of thing. I mean, this person is talking in the first person, and that introduces something utterly foreign to Homeric poetry, unless he happens to have a disuse of somebody telling his own experiences. And you could perhaps find something a little like this in Odysseus's recounting his travels. But there's something about Homer is that he's utterly impersonal for the most part. I mean, he almost never introduces himself. So when he tells the story, I mean, it's not like this at all. But he says, and then so-and-so did such-and-such. He doesn't say, and then I saw so-and-so do such-and-such. So that's an important difference, it seems to me, right from the start. This is the only place I can think of in which Homer is quite personal is when he starts to list all the heroes who came to Troy, all the famous Greek warriors. It's something that he can't do. It's as if I had 1,000 mouths and could talk forever without growing tired, I still couldn't do it without the aid of you muses. You must help me out in this matter. And he briefly comes forward in these few lines, but otherwise he's never there. But I think that there are some tendencies that are the same. And for example, when he describes a person in terms of a simile, for example, he compares Paris to a young horse that's been stabled all winter, and then all of a sudden he's let out, and he heads for the stream where he is wont to disport himself in the summer, and the mayors are there. He heads for them with tosses his head back and so forth. He compares this warrior heading out into the field of battle with this type of thing, and I think there's something in that that's a little similar to his description of the dawn. I mean, he's trying to think of some way to describing it.
Well, yeah,
or describing
that, that's
it.
That's interesting. Except that is so far under our experience that I've seen thinking one thought and saying one thing and thinking another.
Oh, I see what you mean. The notion of comparison and a simile is so foreign to our...
Yeah.
I think that's true, and I think this bothers students, and
they
are affected by it in the same way that Virgil was affected by it when he read Homer. Here is something that is very characteristic of epic poetry, that you compare something to something else. The gathering of the army is like the humming of bees or coming out of a rock, and they keep coming, and they go this way, and they go that way. They're so numerous, and there's infernal buzzing that never stops.
Yeah.
I mean, we just don't think in that way, do
so
we?
So that it actually stands in between you and the army.
I suppose it does, but for Homer, who's talking about this army that he has never seen and which his grandfather had never seen, but he's seen the bees, and he knows what a vivid picture it is of those bees coming out. So this, to him,
right.
Makes it more realistic.
That's right.
But when our students read that, and when Virgil read it, he thought, this is epic. And so when Virgil sat down to write the Aeneid, what does he do? But he puts the same type of thing in, and Milton does the same thing, I suppose, at times. Put similes in to give an epical touch, we might say. And it happens to be historically completely false, because apparently Homer was rather unique in this regard. Most epic doesn't have similes at all. It's just a...
I'd say the instruction literature is basically... all instruction in literature is basically... if a student can survive it, it's a miracle.
Mm-hmm. It gets between him and
it
the
don't
literature.
Matter whether it's Homer or Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow or other, the instructor manages to get in between
mm-hmm.
the student and what he's reading.
Yes.
And the student never sees what he reads.
Mm-hmm.
So... to say so that any sort of talk about why you read one literature and another would just be pure rationalization, pure intellectualizing.
Mm-hmm.
There wouldn't necessarily be any substance to it,
mm-hmm.
none whatsoever. They say you understand Mark Twain better if you read Homer. They could just as well say they'd understand Homer better if you read Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows. And it's just propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
It's institutionalized thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not thought. That's just truth.
Well, I think your objection is a little too sharp. It assumes I don't know this. Something like punching a time clock, you know. Freshman year, you may not get much out of the literature you read, and maybe by senior year, you're beginning to get a little gefoodle or something.
Well,
you get some of it.
And your senior year, you just resign to it.
You just resign to it. You know to get the Barnes Noble outline and like that. But
we haven't got it, though. Now, what I'm trying to get you into some nice passage in Homer. Oh, it doesn't matter if it's Homer or Antigone or any of it doesn't matter.
Well, I don't know. This other matter of saying it's not worth it, I do think that if you're reading a man like Virgil, who's specifically, I won't say imitating Homer, but his whole poetry is as it were, as though you were to dip it in Homer, it's steeped in it. And it's also steeped in Ennius, Virgil's own predecessor. And in those days, literature didn't fill whole libraries as it does for us, but Latin literature, particularly in 50 BC, would have perhaps not filled one very small bookcase, even if it were printed on modern book pages. So, you know, people knew it by heart, most of it. So if Virgil imitates something in Ennius, his predecessor, changing words, perhaps, or slight. It's a little bit like ringing the changes on something. This I think, would invalidate your point of view for that type of literature, that type of learned literature. I wonder if when you listen to Robert Schumann's It's Carnival, isn't it? That in the last movement, he takes some theme or other out of a 16th century chant or something, just as a joke, you see, because his opponents in music had suggested that you had to stick by the rules and the types of things
David
that he did, where David and the Philistines and all of this sort of thing. I think if you don't really know what's going on, you would enjoy the finale to the Carnival, but it becomes much more amusing if you do know what's going on, and it has some, you know, meaning, and perhaps more someone like Stravinsky, for example, who's often doing this sort of clever thing.
He hadn't got to the lyrics yet. Just take a passage.
Oh.
Famous poem about she's sitting there and she sees the young man talking to her own object of her own passion, and she describes how she feels. She says he appears to her equal to the gods, then she says, who sits next to you and hears you sweetly laughing and so forth. What about that poem?
Yeah.
Don't you think that the way in which she describes her own emotions in this situation, she is in love with this person, has something in common with the type of selection that Mark Twain makes in describing this experience of the dawn and getting up on the stagecoach? I mean, I don't think it's necessary for one to read the one to discuss the other, but
I think you can pick up, I mean, what would be interesting to us would be one of the experiences. I remember Hector at the Wall,
mm-hmm.
something like that, which was actual experience.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just pick one of those?
Yes, an experience.
An experience,
yes.
Out of Homer.
And just forget about school.
Yeah. Could you do that? Let's see
well,
how it goes.
You want me just then to describe some
pick
experience
up the
of Homer?
Yeah.
Okay, well, how about Hector is outside the wall, and he has to stay outside the wall, as he tells himself, because he's the one that told him to stay out in the first place when everybody else, Polybus or somebody, said, well, let's go back in the wall, Hector. Achilles is back out on the field again. We're going to get slaughtered. No, I'll handle Achilles. We'll stay out here. So now everyone else is inside the city, but Hector feels he has to stay outside or he'll be accused of cowardice because of what he had said earlier. It is, in fact, his fault that many Trojans have been killed. So he decides to stay outside. But Achilles begins to approach. And as he comes up, his mere appearance is so horrible to Hector and so frightening that Hector begins to think things like, I'll throw down my armor and do what amounts to waving a white flag and make a deal with him. I'll offer that we'll give back Helen and we'll give him half of what's in the city of Troy besides and make peace, and the Achaeans can go back to Greece. And then he realizes that this is an absurdity. Not only is this a promise that he can't make, but Achilles is obviously too furious to consider this anyway, and he realizes that. Then Achilles approaches, and even though Hector has been, as it were, I've read this in some time, building himself up, so that he will have the courage to face Achilles. And what he has done so far is very brave. He has remained outside the wall, even though his family has begged him to come inside, to meet Achilles. But then when Achilles finally does come up, the mere sight of him is so horrible
that
Hector
that he
turns and bolts and runs around the city.
That boast that he went through was to build himself up on him.
I suppose so.
That old warrior's boast.
This warrior's boast, yes.
Yeah, that does it, see.
Uh-huh.
That's nice.
But I've had passages that I've puzzled over and couldn't quite figure out in my dictionary or even with the translation. And I would trot up to class, and Mr. Schlesinger, who's always a very interesting figure, he was very, very old and dignified, but not very good at getting literature across to you if he stopped to explain it. But he had a certain quality about him that made you want to understand it more, so you worked on it yourself, I guess. But he would always read the Greek aloud before he asked you to translate. He didn't usually ask you to read it. He read it himself. And sometimes you'd just listen to him read it, and then you knew what the passage meant. A day or so later, you might look at it again and try to figure it out, and you couldn't remember. I couldn't figure it out, but I heard him read it aloud, and just because he was so familiar with it and knew what it meant,
knew how to read it.
His mere diction made the meaning immediately clear. You know, you didn't.
This is almost a miracle, and it happens.
Yes. Some of them have involved really outstanding figures.
But look how far along you've got to be before you can test Pope's
exactly.
feeling for Homer.
Exactly.
Man, lies.
Yes.
Edition won't do it now.
Yeah.
Of course, you got to be there, guys. It won't do it. Well, that's nice, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Now what are we going to talk about?
Leslie thinks that he'll interesting. No, I'm just talking. This is just all. Yeah.
Well, I hope it will be. I mean, I think that I've always felt sort of isolated in Ithaca, and be more opportunity to hear music, particularly. It's one of my major reasons for wanting to go there.
And you think your own field is better?
For my own field,
there'll
be so many more people there who are working in it that. I mean, I think there'll be a greater chance that I'll find more congenial minds to work with than I have at Cornell. I've been too successful. A couple of my colleagues I get along pretty well with, but I think that's an excuse. But most of them, I don't seem to have too much in common with. When you have 8 people to choose from, I guess it's not so surprising that only 2 of them would be, you know, really congenial. But maybe if I have 30 or 40, I'll find more.
And there's that much difference. In
you mean
size.
In size? Yes, there is. Yes, there is. We have a faculty of about 9, 10, if you count the extra man who's sort of part time.
I would say
15, 20, I think.
Yeah, I would have guessed it'd been the other way. Cornell was by far outnumbered there.
No, Cornell has well, Berkeley's a much larger institution now, I guess, in the liberal arts,
yeah.
and they put a lot of money into their classics, oddly enough, and they rank up with Harvard in classics, in not just in numbers, but in quality and in various other things. Cornell has, I think, fallen down a bit in the humanities, generally, and it's very sad, but the university has not been able to simply put the money into it necessary. I mean, the history department, for example, is there are great gaps in the history department. There's just no one in that area of history, and the students complain about it, and justifiably so. And yet nothing seems to be done about it. This year, for example, getting a new ancient historian in Greek history, or we were planning to get one in the history department, he was a casualty of the cutback budget. And we're not getting anybody. We have one man already who's a pretty good fellow. He's like me. He's young and not very far along. But he's in Roman history, you see. He's been giving the Greek history this year to make do until next year when they could get a Greek historian. They're not getting one, you see. They've had to cut it out because of budgetary problems. And this is really a little bit frightening when you stop and think that one of the finest educational institutions in the country, and certainly has a great reputation and well-deserved, doesn't have a man at any level whose specialty is Greek history. I mean, that's a bit disconcerting, to say the least. I mean, they haven't had anybody in Byzantine material for years. I'm not sure they ever have had, and they talked about getting one, and they decided that they wouldn't build up new areas, but they would try to keep strong in the areas that they had already, and then later perhaps they could branch out. So they don't have anybody in Byzantine, but there are not very many places that do, and this is perhaps not as great a cause for worry. Obviously, they should have somebody, but they don't. But when they don't have somebody in something as basic as this, rather disturbing and disappointing. And I don't know what the answer is when the budget is in such bad state. We are really greatly overexpanded. And now that business is getting rather bad, this means that your endowment, you see, is not paying the same income that it was before, and the university is poorer as costs rise. So the salaries that we offered to my replacement, for example, are over, he's getting $1,500 more than I got 2 years ago. And that's just in 2 years. The cost of hiring an assistant professor has gone up from $9,000 to $10,500. And yet our endowment has gone down slightly because of bad business past year. The bottom fell out of the stock market last year.
The state schools are not so sensitive.
They're not so sensitive, no. They, of course, are sensitive if the government says, well, we cut this, we cut that. That's where their sensitivity comes in. But their actual income is not so sensitive, no, to the ups and downs of the stock market, let us say. And they have more money at their disposal, I think. It's very hard for a private institution to make it. It really is. There seems to be enough money for a few really fine places to do very well. I mean, Harvard University, it did have a deficit last year for the first time in many, many years.
Oh.
It was a small deficit, several hundred thousand dollars. But our deficit was $2 million. Columbia's was 10, I think. Stanford, or Columbia's was 4, Stanford's was 10. I mean, Stanford is in a desperate state in some areas. They are having to cut back drastically because they're enormous deficit. But just a few miles away is Berkeley, and they're beginning to feel the pinch a bit. And the regents have abolished the summer quarter to save money. But, I mean, they were still able to hire me next year and two others in the classics department. Three new appointments they made. Not all of them are completely new. One man, I'm sort of a replacement for somebody who left. So, you know, they're not feeling the same pressures that Stanford is or that Cornell is. So it's a very great problem, and Cornell has again raised the tuition next year. Oberlin's tuition now, it's comparable to Cornell's. It's just so high that where I now in high school and considering Oberlin, you know, looking at catalogs and things, I don't think I would even have considered it, and I think you would have probably advised me that, you know, we should think first Tallahassee, apply to Oberlin in case I get a merit scholarship or something, but I don't think that it would have been even conceivable that I would have thought of going there without a full scholarship or as close to a full scholarship as they could offer. And I don't think you would have suggested it either. I mean, it's just astronomical.
It
I think it's something like $3,000 just for the tuition.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really something. And in those days, it was something like, $475 a semester.
Yeah.
And the very first year, it went up to $575.
Mm-hmm.
And it went up $100 about every year. But my, you know, scholarships usually went up $200 every year, so it helped to offset that. But I do think that this is something that is important, and that is that middle-class people are just not going to be able to even think about going to places like Oberlin and Cornell as much as they used to. They'll have to send their children to Berkeley and places that are much cheaper, because the costs are just getting astronomical. They really are. I don't think that incomes have gone up that much, really, so they have gone up considerably. So the private institution is in a difficult position right now.
Leslie, how's your politics now? You still worried about Greece?
Well, I guess I'm worried about Greece. I don't sympathize with the regime, but I don't really believe that the regime will leave soon. I'm distressed.
Well, the word has got out over here as to what's happening over there.
Yes, more and more. You mean like the torture and things like that, and the big report that was made to the Council of Europe. Yes, that's true, but the sad thing about that is that here this report is released to the Council of Europe, which then is obviously going to kick Greece out. What happens? The United States lobbies to keep Greece in. I mean, this is not only sad, but disgraceful. I think we talked about all this at Christmas, actually, because it had happened before then. But, I mean, the problem is, for me, going to Greece now, is that I am being blamed for something which is more or less beyond my control, namely that the Greek the average Greek thinks that not only did we carry out the coup, but that we are keeping it going. And our hands are not entirely clean, because we do give Greece a considerable amount of military aid, and that does help it quite a bit.
Miss Kennedy couldn't live in this country. She everywhere she goes, they photograph her. You think she just had to go in exile?
I don't know. I imagine in Greece they don't photograph her, but they probably point at her and laugh. Things are much simpler over there. And if she doesn't mind that, well, I don't know. That's a peculiar situation, isn't it? Why she would marry him and at his age, and particularly when there was so much evil gossip about her and him before John Kennedy ever died. On the whole, I would say the whole thing seems sort of unseemly, you know what I mean? Even though, obviously, any woman has the right to marry whoever she pleases after her first husband dies, but it just seems like sort of a tasteless sort of thing to do. But,
well,
he's so old and not at all attractive, and the only thing about him, it seems to me, is his money, and there must be something about him. He's a man who, to me, is one of the most odious people that I don't know that I know. That is to say, whom I don't know personally, but you read about.
What is Al Capp's word? Not odious.
I mean, here's a man who's so rich that he's often mentioned as possibly the richest man in the world. And you can go from one end of Greece to the other, and you will never see any sign of any thing that has been done by him to help the people of Greece. I mean, you know, no hospitals have ever been built, no museums have ever been built. They have all been built by Americans or others from outside. I mean, they have no tradition of philanthropy at all. He's just a cutthroat. I mean, even this tanker that broke down here in Tampa Bay and filled the bay with oil. My sister, by the way, was involved in the cleaning of the ducks with the soap and water, and it was quite a job. They have to wash them 3 or 4 times and then dip them in sawdust, and then they have to keep them for 8 months. I didn't know that, did you?
Mm-hmm.
They have to hold them for 8 months until their own natural oils redevelop and they can take care of themselves. They keep them in pans. But to get back to the subject, that tanker belonged to Aristotle and Nassus. And I don't know whether they'll do anything or not. It would be a suit directed against the company or the captain. It wouldn't affect him directly. But
they can't do much now because they have the governor's race coming up.
That's right, and that will take precedence over anything else. But maybe pollution will be a big issue. I don't know.
I went to this student week programs up here, and Governor, it was all on conservation this year, and Governor Kirk was the keynoter, and I went to hear somebody else, and I just thought I'd sit through him, but he's an able man.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about him much. I haven't followed him.
He can handle the subject, and he can talk for talk. Now, on the television, I don't think he shows up well. He stalls. He ought to have something to go by, you see. You're not prepared. Now, that was my impression, you see, just from a little bit.
Well, yes, because we didn't have any good impressions of him, and this was
This was interesting to have.
Yeah.
He does seem to be good on the conservation side, doesn't he? And this seems to be one of the areas where he had a lot to do with the Everglades thing, I think, and stopping the airport.
Have you paid much attention to what they say about the conservation and the pollution stuff?
You read a lot about it in the news media. I don't have a TV. It is quite frightening when you read about it. I don't know whether it's something that has been building up for a long time and now all of a sudden we're getting it thrown at us. It's obviously become a big political football, and as I did hear, or maybe it was Huntley Brinkley or somebody said, obviously no one is against the environment. I mean, they're all getting on the bandwagon in this sense, but I really find it very discouraging. I don't really think that enough is being done, and I'm not sure that enough can be done. And I think it involves too many people in high places who are very wealthy, who are simply not willing to go to the trouble to to do the measures necessary to prevent the type of pollution that occurs. I visited Denver, Colorado on my way back from San Francisco, and how discouraging it was to find that Denver, Colorado, high up above, it's a mile high and it's in the west. I somehow thought it would be different. I knew it was a big city, but I somehow thought it would be different. It looks exactly like Columbus, Ohio, or Scranton, Pennsylvania. I mean, you name it. It's exactly like it. It has a big airport with a freeway leading to it. The same four or five spiffy skyscrapers downtown. That's the urban renewal, surrounded by block after block of of what needs to be renewed, I guess, or replaced. And then big factories belching enormous amounts of, well, why would anyone want to manufacture anything in Denver, Colorado? I mean, is it necessary? You would think that...
Yes.
With the railroads...
As a committee of 100, I'll just shaking the bushes, you see.
But I mean, and my friend lived in Longmont, which is a good 30 miles north of Denver, and it's right on the big interstate highway, you know, and there's a big loop that goes around Denver, you know, and you come down and you get on the loop and you go down and then you go off to the airport. It's just like Baltimore or something like that. Everything's exactly the same. And on the other hand, when you're heading north on this big highway towards Longmont, you pass this big green sign that says Cheyenne 79. And isn't that really ridiculous to drive to Cheyenne, Wyoming from Denver, Colorado on a four-lane, divided, limited-access highway? There was not a car on that road, and there are people starving to death, and you can't take a bus in New York City. I mean, there's no public transportation in major cities that need it desperately, and you can drive on an interstate highway from Denver, Colorado to Cheyenne, Wyoming. I mean, that's just absolutely absurd. That I don't think that anything more wasteful could possibly be imagined, even in the summer when everybody's going to Yellowstone National Park. I just can't believe that that's really necessary. I just can't believe it. It's just horrible. I mean, we're getting almost like Germany. You know, every town has a Hauptbahnhof, and every town has this and that and the other, and except for those merciful churches or palaces that are preserved from the past, it's just all the same. You know? I mean, why... Yes, and, you know, particularly in the areas where a lot of destruction has taken place. They just rebuilt everything according to the same rigid plan. And it's just frightening to me to think that Denver should have so little character. It had absolutely no character, it seemed to me, different from that of another city, except perhaps you didn't see so many people that looked obviously Italian or something like that, the way you would in a northern, eastern city where you have a large immigrant population. But so what? They all watch TV and they all... had been taught by the TV to do exactly the same things and think exactly the same things. And I think modern communications are just awful. And they're one of the reasons why our civilization may be deteriorating. But it was really very discouraging to me to see that. Just had no character at all. The Oklawaha, you say? I mean, really, that seems to be sort of insult to injury. Why would anyone want to... It seems like it's so far from anything, and that it would be safe, you know. But no, it's not.
Nothing.
Nothing is safe.
Not even our swamp out here.
Mm-hmm.
I heard some of these people on the campus talk about the Corps of Engineers, and there's a book out on it too, and they're scoundrels. They've reduced it to a science. They can know that. And this is what they say, that any big organization like that has so much power that they have a defense arm built in, like the Jesuits.
Mm-hmm.
It's built in. And they have unlimited money, and they can put it in the direction they want to. Now they say they raise a question about this Northwest Passage, you see, for oil up there, and it's a fragile environment.
Mm-hmm.
But there's absolutely no possibility of scotching that.
Mm-hmm.
Too much money is involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that just carries its own acceleration.
Right.
It's absolutely nothing to do. You write your congressman about it, and he will write you a sympathetic letter, but there's nothing he could do.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing Congress could do.
Where do the cabinet men come from? Well, he's from Wall Street.
Yeah, there's nothing the cabinet can do.
Doesn't want to do anything. It's got the money in it.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. But those things are so huge that they're unapproachable. And from inside, I'm not sure. I don't know about that. From inside. But now the Corps of Engineers has been a striking arm all over the country. It's gone in and done things that people really didn't want done.
Mm-hmm.
But they got the Chamber of Commerce behind it. That's all there is to it. And they say the Chamber of Commerce wants it, but the Corps of Engineers gets the Chamber of Commerce into it.
Yeah.
How that works, I heard, let me tell you.
Some of the drink companies immediately went into putting sugar in their drinks because they were pretty sure within a year or so saccharin would be harmful too. And I wonder if this isn't true of the pesticides.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll probably find out that the others are just as bad if they work on them for a while. I mean, obviously the Lord didn't intend for us to live with pesticides.
Unless
they
picked it up
just so bad. The businessmen, you see, they've all, you know, built into every profession, the engineers, the businessmen, the insurance men, all like that, there's a sort of a propaganda line built into them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you puncture that, it's rather hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
It flattens them out. But now you see the businessmen, they have lied so much,
mm-hmm.
like the automobile people, see, about the exhaust.
Yeah.
They stall, they lie, and they everything they can do.
It's a way of life for them.
Yeah. Now, you know, this Life magazine,
mm-hmm.
had this about the banks putting out this credit card,
mm-hmm.
and just mailing it out to broadcast, and people are getting out in the wrong hands, and you get sued. I knew one of the little girls in my class dropped out, and I had a little weak voice over the phone called me one day, said she couldn't come to class. She had to hire out, that she was getting warrants from the sheriffs in five counties, and that's what happened to her. Somebody had got her card and ran
mm-hmm.
up a bill on
mm-hmm.
her, and she didn't have the money to pay them off.
Mm-hmm.
And now you see, banks, we used to talk about the small loan companies. Just being sort of unscrupulous.
Mm-hmm.
They are nothing compared to the banks.
They've all folded.
Well, the banks can really shake the foundation. Yeah. Now, what's that going to do? Now, and they say, don't you know, they say violence burning the cities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any, I don't think they ought to leave the banks out of that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't burn the cities, but they give us all those shocks. That is, there's no thrift anymore. There's no honest money anymore. Now, you talk about the foundations, God Almighty.
Inherited in 1975.
Well, now, why is that?
It's up in Ithaca in my apartment. It's interesting. I went to the Cornell Federal Credit Union, which I thought would give lower rates, and they wouldn't do it. They said, if you're going to Berkeley, we can't do it. We can't repossess a piano in Berkeley, California. The risk to us is too great. So I went back to the people I was going to buy it from, and I said, well, I don't think I'll be able to do it. The credit union says no. And she said, well, let me go down and try the Tompkins County Trust, because we're willing to co-sign on the loan for security, and they'll probably do it. As it turned out, I got better terms for 5 years from the Tompkins County Trust than I was going to get for six with the Cornell Federal Credit Union. I mean, it's just a fiction that they give better terms. They don't give better terms at all. It so happens that the local bank gives better terms, and you can't seem to go by any rule of thumb anymore. Everyone always said the credit union was the best place because they give better rates, and they don't. But, I mean, this is something, the way I look at it is this. I will never have the cash to buy a Steinway piano. I will never have it. If I save everything that I can save from now until 5 years from now, the money will be gone. I don't know what it will go for. Someone will be ill. I will have to pay for it. Something will happen, you know, and I won't have that money. Besides, 5 years from now, when I have my $5,000 or $4,600 saved up, the Steinway will cost $6,000, and I still won't have enough, so I'll have to go to the bank to borrow $1,000 and pay it off at $50 a month for a year. I feel that anything that I will never have enough money for to buy is, I might as well buy it on credit. And the sooner I can do it, the better, because the prices are now lower than they will be 2 or 3 years from now. On the other hand, something that I could save money for and buy, something in the purchase range of $200 or $300, I realize every time I buy something like that on credit that I'm making a mistake. But there is another way of looking at it, and that is that any kind of interest you pay on loans and so forth is deductible from my income tax. And right now, you may say, well, why spend money, which you have to spend, which you would like to have, just so you can deduct the interest from your income tax? It doesn't really help that much. That's true, but when you consider how high my income tax is, because I'm a single man, anything I can deduct is really to my advantage. And any money that I put in the bank, not only is the interest I earn on it not as great as the rate of inflation, that's really frightening when you think of it. I got something like $4.50 on almost $500, which I had in the bank for several months, and in fact, it had gone down in value, even adding interest to it. I could not, had I made this a down payment on a Steinway in November, it would have been worth, in a sense, something like 6% more than it was when I used it in March, even though I had $4 interest. And that $4 interest had to be added to my income on my income tax, you see.
Now with your Steinway, you will float along with the inflation.
Exactly.
Your values will go up.
Exactly. When I get it to the West Coast, if I were to sell it, say, next fall, I think I could probably do quite well. I mean, I think I could perhaps clear a little, even though it weren't quite new. I've heard of people who've had upright pianos and who've somehow lugged them out to California and sold them for more than they paid for them because they were, you know, in greater demand out there. Obviously, I don't want to do that, but there is something in it. If I were to buy one out there, I'll bet it would be at least $500 more from the shipping.
Well, for one thing, you don't buy a Steinway grand every day in your life.
No, you don't. And I feel it's an investment which will be, you know, once for all, I hope.
Well, that's that beautiful visit with Leslie. He's talking a little bit too far from the microphone. Faye never gets close to the microphone. On, when was it? Thursday night, after I got back from taping Cook Mac for 2 hours and a half. This is the end of Channel 1 Over. The end of Channel 1 Over on Haven's Reel. Channel 1 Over on Haven's Reel. Thursday, the 2nd of April, 1970. And the end of Channel 1 Over. And the talk towards bedtime, way after supper, with Leslie. Leslie Sweet, after supper.